Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Dr. Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Cancer Q&A. And today we're going to talk about common questions posed by patients and family members with relapsed and refractory multiple myeloma. We're thrilled to partner with the Cancer Care Advocacy and Support Group, including their Blood Cancer's Patient Support Group on this project. Some of the patients you'll see are working with Cancer Care, a fantastic group. We have a great faculty today. These are two researchers and experts in multiple myeloma. Today's program is going to be directed towards patients and their families. We have Dr. Natalie Callender from the University of Wisconsin Carbone Cancer Center in Madison, Wisconsin, and Dr. Sagar Loniel from the Winship Cancer Institute, Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta. We also had four other nationally recognized experts in multiple myeloma that we did a survey on, and we'll show the results of these surveys as we go through this. Again, common questions that patients with myeloma have. So thanks to these faculty members. We are going to be talking about relapsed refractory multiple myeloma and other patients who are, after initial treatment, then have a progression of the disease. These are just the financial disclosures of all the people that are working in the faculty here today. We will also be talking about the use of agents and regimens that are not FDA approved. And so if anyone's interested specifically in what is approved and the information related to that, you can check out the so-called prescribing information for the agents and treatments that we're going to be talking about today. And the key to this is over the last few weeks, I've had the pleasure of speaking individually with nine people. A lot of these are actually patients of the faculty and then others of Cancer Care, et cetera. I spoke with each person for up to an hour, hearing about their experiences, asking them what they would like me to ask Drs. Callender and Loniel tonight. And, you know, we're only going to show short excerpts of these conversations, but I learned a lot just talking to these nine people, and I hope we can translate that into something useful. Again, we're going to take this content and distribute it through social media, streaming platforms like YouTube, podcast, our website, and app. So this is just the beginning, and we're really excited about that. Here's where we're heading today. Each one of these modules is going to begin with a short video from one of these patients, sometimes more than one. But I just want to take a step back for a second before we get started and just reflect back a little bit on where we've come. We as a group, continuing medical education group, started working with myeloma, started doing programs in 2005. But we do programs on every part of cancer. We have specialists here tonight, but most patients with cancer are treated in the community by general medical oncologists, and we're doing programs for them all the time, breast cancer, bladder cancer, leukemias, et cetera. And I just want to, take a breath and Natalie start out a little bit and reflecting back on what's happened. We know in every part of oncology, every time we do a program, did a program, incidentally, last week on lung cancer, where we were talking about bispecifics for the first time in small cell lung cancer. So, science and technology is part of every corner in oncology nowadays, but it hasn't necessarily affected how long people live and the quality of their life as much as there are variations in that. Natalie, to me, myeloma is way up there in terms of how it's actually affecting patients in terms of their experience with the disease. So before we start talking about where we are today, particularly in the relapse setting, can you kind of paint a little bit of a picture of when we started out with the so-called RVD regimen and where we are today?
Well, I think, even going, stepping back a little bit, I suspect maybe Dr. Loniel and I are some of the few people who've actually given oral melphalan and prednisone, for many years ago. And really, things were pretty grim, up until about the year 2000. Median average survival was around a couple of years. And often that time was not very good, that people were quite sick. They were breaking bones. They were in the hospital with infections. And so it seems like a long time ago, but RVD was a huge step forward because we really were able to give a combination that started putting people in remission, meaning that not only did their labs improve, but a lot of the side effects that they were experiencing, such as the bone fractures, didn't seem to happen as much. And the reduction in quality of life. And I think we've just been very fortunate to have these additional layers that are continuing to improve people. And again, back in 2005, we weren't promising people that they could get into remission. We had a plan. We were going to do this RVD. We were going to do transplant. We just learned, at the end of the 2000s about maintenance. That was a big innovation that really improved survival quite a bit. And now it just seems like, for particularly somebody who's recently been diagnosed, that we have these great combinations. But this has really been a big step forward, so that we can now, for the majority of people newly diagnosed, say we really do have an excellent chance of putting your myeloma under control for a long period of time. And that's just been amazing, I think, in my lifetime. And Sagar, I don't know about you.
Yeah, I'm curious what your thoughts are, Sagar, and also the model for myeloma in mm-hmm. terms of how you view it compared to, say, solid tumors like breast mm-hmm. cancer, like lung cancer. You know, when I think about myeloma, I think more about a model of, chronic disease management. And we see this with chronic myelogenic leukemia, where patients take pills for indefinitely. Most of them are not able to stop, but yet live a normal lifespan. Sagar, any thoughts about, again, where we've come over the last 20 years?
Yeah, no, I think Dr. Callender hit a lot of really important highlights in terms of what we've been able to do in the last 20 years. I think the ability to talk to patients about, I've got a plan, and that plan for you, we hope, will last 10 plus years. That was something we were sort of guessing back in the late 2000s, meaning 2008, 2009, 2010. Now it's something I routinely say to patients now that, we're going to get you into a remission that with potentially DARA RVD could last on average 10 to 12 years. And then by then I'll have other tricks that I can pull out that will help really change the natural history. One of the points that I think it is important to make, especially given that we have a lot of patients on this call, is that there's this push to say, well, and if I'm going to pick on transplant as one example, you don't need a transplant because we can do just as well with these combinations in some patients. And my worry is we've spent the last 20 years not being happy with just as well. We want to do better. We constantly want to move the field forward. And so I don't accept the argument that just as well is good enough. I want it to be better. And I think I'm sure that Natalie would agree with that.
Yeah, I would.
So we're going to go through with this fairly rapidly and just ask each one of you for your thoughts on some mm-hmm. of the questions and issues that came up with patients. So I'm going to begin with what I'm calling questions from the beginning, questions that I think you start hearing from the diagnosis and maybe continue hearing, and a number of things that these people brought up. I'd like you to listen to that.
What is the youngest patient you've ever seen that had myeloma? It seems like it's an older disease. I don't know too many women that have multiple myeloma. It seems like most of the people I know are men. I really think I got mine from this stuff called Roundup, which is basically Agent Orange. I had a 50-gallon tank. I'd go and spray my field lines or fence lines with it. And I'd come in dripping wet in my hair, in my face, in my clothes.
One of the big things I have discussed with my doctor, also in support groups, about a cure for it. More information about that. And I believe hopefully there will be a cure one day.
One thing about myeloma patients is you never get to ring that bell that most patients that finish treatment. So I think it's important to realize when myeloma patients are in with everybody and they hear that bell, there's a little punch in the gut when you hear it.
So we could talk a long time about these issues, right. But Natalie, starting out with the youngest patient, typical age that you see, I should have mentioned that first patient actually is a farmer, a little bit of an unusual occupation for a woman. She brings up the question of whether men get myeloma more commonly. Any thoughts, Natalie?
Yeah, I would say the youngest person that I've seen has been 21. I don't know what Sagar, something similar. It is the average age when people get myeloma is about 70. It has been somewhat more in excess for men than women, and there is epidemiology that connects public health data that connects exposure with certain toxins potentially with an increased risk of myeloma. Herbicides, there's been an increased risk documented in exterminators. We don't really know much about how that works, but I think it's a factor. And then I think just to speak to your last guest who was talking about ringing the bell, I very much appreciate that. I do think I have to circle back a little bit to what Sagar said, is that I think he and I are delighted to see people who are in our clinics for, you know, 15 years, 20 years. Many of them may still be taking some chemotherapy, but, you know, I think that that was really unimaginable in 2005.
So just to elaborate, you know, there's this tradition, and I don't know how often it's done in infusion centers, oncology infusion centers, when people, particularly adjuvant treatment of breast cancer, where they get a defined period of treatment and then they stop and hopefully they're cured. And you heard in the myeloma is a more of a continuous treatment. But Sagar, I would bring back that model of chronic CML, where you take pills for your life and you live and you die of something else. Maybe you ought to be ringing the bell when you die of something else. I don't know. But any thoughts about sort of thinking through and also this issue brought up by one of the patients about cure?
Yeah, no, I think those are really good questions. And for the sake of transparency, that third patient was actually my patient. So I've taken care of her for almost 18 years now. And so I think I think the idea of a chronic disease is one that I try and stress. You know, I ask them if they have high blood pressure and they take their antihypertensive, are they ever cured of their high blood pressure? And that analogy is sort of the way I think about it as well. If you take a pill and you control it, that's a good thing. I think it's different when it's cancer, but still, I think that's a valid argument. What I think we are on the precipice of today, though, is between bispecifics and CARs and all of these highly active combinations, I think we're going to get to that point where we can reliably discontinue therapy and it may result in cure. I don't think we had the tools back in 2007, 2008, until we started to get antibodies, which we got in 2015, until we started to get bispecifics and CARs. Now I think we can get to a point where we can discontinue therapy. I don't know what the right benchmark is, but at least in the IMS, IMWG definition, the response criteria, we now have defined what it means to be cured, and what we're putting a stamp on something out there, and we'll test it going forward. But that was never in the response criteria before.
So I just want to say also that all these slides that we're showing are also in the chat room if you want to take your time and read through them, including these slides from our survey. And it's interesting, you know, how people answer, you know, basic question, can I be cured? Depends how you define cure. You talk about, for example, functional cure, where, as you say, you take a pill and you know, eventually die of something else. But interesting that people have different visions of, you know, what to say to patients at this point. Also, in terms of the question of how long will people be nowadays be on their therapy that they're started on? And so, and you can see estimates up to 10 years. So you get treated. You may have to take a pill or other therapy as maintenance therapy, but you will not, you know, and currently people may not need to not be treated for as long as 10 years. And then the other question, and kind of getting into back into this issue of ringing the bell because you're finished, that most people still are thinking about continuous therapy, even though in some situations with new assays, et cetera, maybe there's going to be a consideration to hold off on therapy. So I want to sort of move into the next set of comments I heard about, and it kind of relates to the issue of making decisions in myeloma. And the fact that nowadays, because there have been so many new agents and treatments that come out, particularly in the relapse setting, that often there's a choice in, you know, even the art of oncology and trying to match up a treatment for a patient. And there's a lot of interest from these people when I talk to them about how doctors do that. How do you make a decision? And to what extent do you involve the patients? Let's hear what a couple of the other people said.
When I talk with my doctor, she will have a variety of things that are available. And these are the specific things about this one. And these are the things that they've seen. Would you, you know, prefer this kind of treatment? How do you like infusions? Here's one that just requires you to take pills for the most part. There are advantages that each one of the different drugs may have, and so you get to choose now. One of the questions that I have is, with all the developments that they've had in treatments, how do you go about deciding what would be a reasonable one? What's a poor doctor to do in these days for their relapse patients? How do they go about deciding what is a reasonable next course?
How do you direct patients who are unsure which direction to take their treatments? So there's so many options, A, B, C, or D.
Have you yourself been in a situation where you were presented with multiple options?
For sure. And I always turn to my medical person and I say, well, if I were your mother or your daughter, what would you do? And I think I always get the right answer.
Any thoughts, Sagar?
Yeah, you know, I think there are some core principles around how to navigate the multiple choices. For me, the first question is, what is the treatment that is likely to give them the longest remission? That's sort of my first question. And if you're going to talk about functional cure, you have to be shooting for the longest remission at each relapse, so at each stage of when that question comes up. The second then is, well, okay, so let's say you've got two or three different choices. Then you start to go into, these are the upsides of this approach. These are the upsides of the other approach. Where does it fit into your lifestyle? Where does it fit into what you want to do? And what are the clinical trial opportunities that we have that may potentially supplant what I'm offering you off trial? And how do you make that amalgamated decision overall? But most of the time patients say to me, well, I don't know this field. You know this field. What would you do? And I give them what our group has decided we're going to do in most of these first relapse, second relapse, third relapse situations.
And Natalie, you know, another issue here is how you involve the patient and their family if they want to be involved in understanding what the options are. How does that actually play out?
Well, in general, and I think Sagar would agree with this, we certainly want to support clinical trials and research. What I try to do, and I think Sagar will agree with this, when you're presenting a clinical trial and walking people through it, it takes a lot of time. And it often takes multiple conversations on multiple days to really have people comfortable with the idea. A lot of people come in with I don't want to be a guinea pig statement. I'm sure you've heard that, Sagar, many times. I think just to add a little bit to what Sagar said, I think there are instances where I really give people a strong recommendation about what they should do. I think that there are some instances where there may not be so much of, you know, A, B, C, D, as your patient Sagar was saying, but really something where this is going to be the best option you can consider. Because I think if you know that, if you believe that, that's very helpful to patients and families.
So there's a lot of interest in clinical trials in these patients. A lot of these people went from one clinical trial to another because nowadays you can actually, it's not just the question of helping future patients with cancer, but you yourself can benefit. I remember we did a program with myeloma patients a couple years ago, and I talked to a man who was on, we're going to talk about bispecific. He was on a bispecific antibody. He'd been on it for 2 years when I talked to him. And about the same time that I talked to him was the time it was approved. So he'd already been on it for 2 years when it became available, which is a real example of how people can actually benefit by being in a trial. Here's some of the questions from the patients and comments.
I'm a big supporter of clinical trials. The experiences I've had with the clinical trials is that it's kind of like you get special treatment. And I don't want to imply that you're not taken care of normally under treatment, but it just seems like the care and the amount of work, you know, all the laboratory work and everything, extra stuff that they have to do kind of leads you to think that you're getting really special care.
Now, I have talked to my oncologist about the clinical trial actually last week when I saw him. There's always new stuff coming out, new information. I want to know how people are choosing. How does it work, the clinical trial? How do you get someone for the clinical trial or they're eligible for that clinical trial?
What's next in the pipeline? What's coming down the road? And where is research being done? At the NIH, I've gone from one new treatment to the next, and I'm going to keep going.
I'm curious if you hear patients talk about the MRD assay.
It seems as though it's giving people false sense of hopes of being cured. And everybody's saying, oh, you know, I'm MRD negative and I'm cured. I'm on a Facebook group and, you know, everyone's just high-fiving each other about the MRD negative and everybody's cancer-free. And it's throwing people for a loop.
So, Natalie, any thoughts? Mm-hmm. We asked our group here about benefits. If we look at the survey, most of them feel the likelihood that participating in a trial can be beneficial to patients. Can you talk a little bit about some of the patient comments and also what MRD is, minimal residual disease, that one of the patients mentioned now being done often, both on clinical trials and off of it?
Yeah. Well, I think, and for full disclosure, the first gentleman is a patient of mine. And I do think that we meet people who are very much, tell me what trial I can go on next. And I think that actually is always, to me, very very gratifying, because I think that it means that people really understand that we are doing these trials with the goal of making care better. And many, many of the trials these days either offer something that is, you know, really looks that it's going to be an improvement, or, you know, guarantees a participant that they will have at least what is as good as we know how to do right now. So I think that that's very important. MRD is a minimal residual disease, or some people like to say minimal detectable disease, but it is a yardstick that we have right now that helps us decide if the therapy may be good enough or maybe complete enough. But there are some nuances here that I think we are still trying to learn, that how fast you might get to that endpoint may have to do with the biology of your myeloma and maybe also elements of the treatment you're receiving. I think it is a useful tool at this point, but I think we are still just appreciating how to use it as we're going forward.
Sagar, any comments? And again, I see that you estimate that the mass majority of people going in trials actually benefit themselves. Also about what's coming down the pike, so to speak. What's the next great thing? We're going to talk about several things that have come out recently over the last couple of years, but it looks like, for example, so-called cell mods. Everybody mentions that. What are cell mods? Any other comments about MRD?
Yeah, cell mods are an exciting sort of new class of agents that are cereblon binders. So like the IMiD class, they have the same target, but they bind with a lot more potency. And in addition to binding cereblon and killing myeloma cells at a more efficient and effective way, they also activate T cells and NK cells. And so in my mind, make themselves perfect partners for every immune therapy that is being developed today. So bispecifics, CAR T cells, antibody drug conjugates, even anti-CD38 antibodies, all of these are better when they're combined with a cell mod than when they're combined with the old IMiD class of either Len or POM, and the toxicity is significantly lower. So I think in that sense, it really is exciting. The point that I'll make, the fact that MRD is a moment in time, and that where I think it is most useful is its sustainability. 2-year and 3-year sustained MRD negativity is a pathway that I think has real value and meaning. But a single time point to me is like taking the first step up a flight of stairs. You need to do it, but it's not the end of the road.
And we see people using MRD in many different parts of oncology. It doesn't mean that you might not have a future problem. It just means it's a lot less likely. You know, we're going to take little pieces of this hour today and test them out and see what people like and don't like. I wanted to bring up another very clinical topic that often comes up in people with myeloma. And many of these people talk to me about having neuropathy. It may begin in the very first type of treatment that includes a so-called proteasome inhibitors like bortezomib that can cause neuropathy. Here are some of the experiences and questions that we'll ask the faculty about from the patients.
The RVD caused severe neuropathy, and I lost all feeling below my knees.
Do you still have the neuropathy now?
Oh, yes, sir. I have absolutely no feelings from the knees down. I was on huge doses of gabapentin that first year, and it didn't seem to do anything. So they took me off of that. Every now and then, I will get sharp pain shooting through my feet, even just sitting there.
Anything you've been treated with or done that helped the neuropathy?
I had acupuncture and massage once a week for 2 years, and it made a significant difference in my pain levels. And so that was, you know, a good thing.
I have neuropathy in my feet and the tips of my fingers a little bit. It's gotten better, though, since I've been on this treatment. They get really tingling and hot sometimes, and then it makes it hard to walk a little bit, or I just want to take my shoes off. But they feel like they're hot, but they're not really hot.
So, Natalie, any comments mm-hmm. about the spectrum of what you see? And also, a lot of times you see the neuropathy reverse and go away. It didn't in these situations. And also, what you recommend to patients.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last speaker is a patient of mine who, given the era and in some of the very difficult situations clinically, did have exposure to bortezomib a number of occasions, and actually was diagnosed at a time when we were still doing bortezomib twice a week. And that, I think, we are getting better at trying to learn how to prevent or at least delay the onset of neuropathy. But it's a very difficult problem. I think it's one of the ones, particularly the first gentleman who spoke, when it's long lasting like that, I do think our interventions are imperfect at best. I mean, so gabapentin can help some of the symptoms. Time will help in many cases, but not all. I think acupuncture is a great idea. What is limited use of it for some of my patients is just money, because it's typically not covered by insurance, and they just the sessions are not inexpensive, and to have many, many is difficult.
Sagar, any thoughts?
Yeah, so I agree with Natalie. I think we're just better at managing neuropathy. And quite honestly, this is where the team-based approach to care is really important. Early on in the days of bortezomib, and in case any of my patients are listening, we still use twice a week bortezomib in the induction phase setting. But at the first sign of grade one neuropathy, we back off and go to once a week dosing. In order to try and minimize that risk. So our nurses now should be asking before each dose of bortezomib, have you developed any numbness or tingling? And that triggers us to hold a dose or make a dose adjustments. The best way to deal with neuropathy is prevention. There's no question about that. But the acupuncture piece is real. I mean, I will say that. And physical therapy really does make a difference over time, as does getting further away from bortezomib exposure.
And also kind of also ties in a little bit. I was thinking about a principle we talk about in management of many different types of cancers, Natalie, which is dose reduction of a treatment mm-hmm. because of toxicity. Mm-hmm. A lot of times mm-hmm. patients get very nervous or afraid that it's not going to be as effective. But we've seen over and over again in every part of oncology, you can safely reduce the dose.
Absolutely.
And as Sagar said, avoid the problem in the first place.
Right. No, I can't agree more with that. And I think, we're seeing it now even in the modern era. You know, the top dose of iberdomide has been dropped. I mean, just because it does not look any more efficacious. That's a new one of the cell mods that Sagar mentioned. I think that we're very much, particularly with the older drugs like lenalidomide, I think a lot of us believe that staying on a smaller dose is far preferable than taking the top dose, but only for a couple of months.
Yep.
So we're going to now talk about three of the most exciting developments in myeloma that have come out of research trials. Mm-hmm. The first, I think we already alluded to, so-called CAR T therapy, chimeric antigen receptor T cell therapy. Sagar, before we get the patient's experience with that, can you explain basically what it is?
Yeah, CAR T cell, as you mentioned, is certainly one of the newer, more exciting treatment options that we have. And what it does is basically take out the patient's own T cells. They then get shipped off to a central manufacturing site where those T cells are then manipulated in a way that they are taught how to target a very specific receptor. And in the most common ones we use, BCMA, or B cell maturation antigen, is that receptor they are taught to target. Once the manufacturing is over, it then gets sent back to the site. Patients receive low-dose chemotherapy, or what we call lymphodepletion, and then those T cells are given back, And when it works dramatically fast. I had the first patient I gave a CAR T cell to had a growth of plasma cells on their skull that you could see was protruding about 6 or 7 centimeters. Within 24 hours of that infusion, that growth was gone. That's how quickly it can be effective.
And the amazing thing, this is really immune therapy, you know, taking advantage of the immune system. Very right. different concept than, for example, chemotherapy. Natalie, I'd like to listen to you to listen to what these patients have to say. One of the things that's different about CAR T, we were talking about the fact that people with myeloma often get continuous treatment. Then in this situation, after they get the CAR T, they can often hold off on having to have treatment for a while, which of course is viewed as a great benefit. Here are the patients. How was the CAR T? How was it going through that experience for you?
Compared to the stem cell transplant, it was a piece of cake. Having so much time with people and being isolated and the people I was with was challenging. I like that it's one and done and then I can move on instead of always having to go in and, you know, going to the hospital every 3 months. That's 4 times a year. That's nothing.
One of the things that I was not aware of before I did CAR T was that CRS doesn't just happen in the hospital, that the symptoms of CRS can happen afterwards. We got a list of neurological things to look for, but I had stuttering for 3 weeks.
Really?
And and not knowing that was part of having CRS.
Wow.
I didn't know that. I also couldn't walk in a straight line for about a week. Hmm. And that was also a part of CRS, but both of those symptoms didn't start until I had been home a couple of months.
One of the side effects that I personally have from CAR T is I have a tick in my left arm now. So my left arm will just start shaking almost like I have Parkinson's or something, you know, a Parkinson's type something. It just, my left arm just will shake all the time.
So, Natalie, two of the syndromes that we've seen with CAR T, and actually we're going to talk about this with the bispecifics, is so-called CRS, cytokine release syndrome, but also ICANS, neurologic problems. I think actually what the patient was describing with the stuttering might be more neurologic. Can you explain what those are, why they happen, and what usually happens to patients?
Yeah, at least the kind of straightforward explanation of cytokine release syndrome is that we believe that these T cells that are engineered, as Sagar said, to recognize a specific portion of the myeloma cell, but they're also manipulated to be sort of boosted or, you know, kind of on fire, if you will, when they're injected, so that as soon as they hit, they are active and they in turn can cause other normal cells in the body to release certain chemicals that cause all sorts of things like fever and changes in blood pressure and sometimes changes in oxygen. And it sets up almost kind of a cascade that can be very short-lived or happen a long, long time. And similarly, the immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome, or ICANS, is thought to be a feature of those CAR T cells actually getting into the central nervous system and potentially even into brain tissue itself and causing disruption of neural transmission and causing some irritation of the nerves that leads to the side effects that they were alluding to in their comments.
So Sagar, here's what the faculty said, including the two of you, about the effectiveness. It looks like most patients do respond. We also asked, and you can look at read these afterwards, Natalie just summarized some of the key issues in terms of tolerability. Anything you want to say about CAR T, Sagar, and also why it seems like at some point often these patients will develop relapse, whereas when CAR T is used in certain lymphomas, and we're going to actually do a program like this one in that situation, they may be cured.
Yeah, in my mind, and I don't think anybody knows the right answer to that question, but at least in my mind, I think it has to do with CAR T cell persistence. In many of the lymphomas that you described, their CAR Ts are around forever. They never really go away. And you know that because their immunoglobulin levels remain really low because CD19 is continuing to be targeted. In myeloma, we can see that somewhere between month 6 and month 12, most times patients will begin some level of immunoglobulin recovery on their own, which is good because it means they're not immunosuppressed, but it means that the CAR is likely gone. You mentioned one and done earlier in terms of the treatment approach. I actually put patients who have reasonable counts on some form of maintenance between months 3 and months 12 with the hope that I can keep that car going longer. And it's totally theoretical. I don't know that I'm making a difference. But I think, if you do a little bit of pomalidomide, for instance, 2 milligrams, 3 weeks on, 1 week off with no steroids, if it's tolerated well and it does make a difference, then it's a win. And we're looking to see whether or not that is making a difference.
So, Natalie, when CAR-T mm-hmm. came out in the yep. beginning, one of the issues was that you had to use the patient's own cells, with the mm-hmm. process that we just described. And people were saying, well, why can't we do the same strategy with something that's, quote, off the shelf? You don't need right. to take the patient's cells. So right. just take a medication and give it to them. And then, lo and behold, we started to see that with so-called bispecific antibodies. Can you explain what they are, Natalie?
Yeah. So this is a way to try to get your own immune cells, your T cells, to recognize myeloma cells directly. In theory, you need to have a middleman that makes that interaction happen. And we don't really understand why that middleman is either not active or not there normally. But in this case, you're using an antibody that simply seems to hook together a T cell and the myeloma cell through a couple of different mechanisms. And once that T cell is next to the myeloma cell, it is capable of destroying it, of incapacitating it.
So I mentioned the man that I interviewed a couple of years ago mm-hmm. on the teclistamab. Yeah. There are a couple other patients here that also received teclistamab. The man I talked to had no problem. He just cruised right through it. But you can hear what happened to these two people.
How effective is CAR-T? For me, it was the best thing to happen for me because I went off of chemo for a year and a half. That was wonderful. But I'd like to know how other patients responded to these drugs like CAR-T. And the one, this, I guess it's teclistamab that I'm on.
How's that been for you?
Well, I love it. I feel a little poopy like 48 hours later, not the next day. I just feel kind of draggy. Right now, I couldn't be happier. I just hope it will hold up.
What was it like when you got the first treatment?
Well, the first one I had kind of a reaction, but not terrible. The second one I had no reaction. I thought I'm home free. The third one was a killer. It was like triple the dose. I had like 105 fever. I was throwing up. My blood pressure dropped out. It was, they said I was minutes away from intensive care. But then it all turned around.
And I've been on teclistamab for almost 2 years. This is the longest that I've gone in response for this amount of time. And so I'm just trying to enjoy the ride.
Any side effects or issues with the teclistamab?
Yes. So teclistamab was the hardest drug that I actually ever went on. I had the side effects from the very first dosage. I was disorientated. I had nausea. I had body aches, hand tremors, body tremors. It was a really, really tough time. And it didn't straighten out for about 4 months. And then it got much better.
And now do you have any side effects from it?
No. I was also in the hospital with a woman who was at least 20 years older than me. And she was skipping around and she had her second dose. So, you know, it just goes to show you that no two apples are the same.
So, Sagar, you know, the thing we hear about is a lot of the potential side effects of bispecifics are actually similar to CAR-T, but usually a lot less intense. Can you talk about your experience with these agents and where you think that's heading?
Yeah, the way that I sort of describe it when I'm talking through it with patients is that compared to the lymphoma CAR-T, the myeloma CAR-Ts are on average one grade lower for both CRS and ICANN. And the bispecifics for myeloma are on average one grade lower than the myeloma CAR-Ts. So it really is significantly lower. The incidence of neurologic stuff is single digits in terms of the frequency. And I think What the patients here described is not uncommon to have some level of CRS. It probably is related in part to tumor burden, but at least what our center has taken on, and we've now published on, I think, 150 patients, is giving preemptive tocilizumab. So we give the toci before or right around that first dose, and it lasts for about a week. And in doing that, we reduce CRS from 70% to 20%. And so I think those kinds of strategies are going to come more frequently.
Natalie, anything you want to add to that? Can you explain what tocilizumab is? How do you decide what comes first, bispecifics or CAR T? And is there an age where you maybe start thinking twice about using either one of these?
Well, tocilizumab blocks one of the chemicals that can be released, interleukin-6, and it's quite effective at bringing down the side effects, particularly of CRS, very quickly. Sometimes, as soon as you give a dose, people don't get it again, which is great. I think in terms of what these two patients were describing, actually, I think I've seen that quite a bit, where people just say they're sort of draggy. They're not needing to be in the hospital, but they're kind of they don't feel right, I guess. Sometimes tired. And I had people who said they're a little fuzzy, but you know, getting out after 4 to 5 months, and particularly, obviously, people are delighted if they've had a great response. I think that helps a lot. But then for at least a significant number of patients that I've treated, they really feel like this turns out to be a quite easy to accommodate therapy, particularly if they're on a much more sort of prolonged interval. So I think that's been really pretty exciting. The sequencing, Sagar and I could probably go on about this for a long time. I mean, right now there is some concern that if you tried to do a CAR T that is BCMA directed immediately after a BCMA directed bispecific, it may affect either the T cells that you're harvesting are not as good, or there is some deleterious effect of doing that. So I think most people are not; they're trying to avoid it. But then there have been patients who've had a bispecific, and then maybe 6 months to a year later, going on to a BCMA CAR T would be fine. But I'm sure Sagar has some comments as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of sequence, I agree with Natalie's approach. And we take something. Sometimes it's a matter of, can they even wait for the CAR? And if they can't, right, then you do whatever you can in your hand to quickly make a decision. But, you know, one of the things that, as you're talking about dose reductions and dose modifications, I mean, at least at our program, we very quickly go to once a month dosing for all the bispecifics, because you just don't need that once a week or twice a week or every other week or whatever the dosing schedule is for any of them. You don't need it once a patient's had a VGPR or better. And I think that has a significant impact on the side effects as well as the toxicity in general, particularly infection complications.
And as we talked about, you often see myeloma in older people, and yet older people are able to tolerate bispecifics. And you were both telling me before we started, you've had patients in their early 80s go for CAR T. So it's not like a transplant. Here are some of the thoughts from our faculty about response to bispecifics. Most of them see the majority of patients responding. We talked about the types of side effects, again, similar to CAR T, but not as difficult. So I want to get into one other class of new agents, and we talk about this all the time in oncology. There are multiple so-called antibody-drug conjugates being tested. This is a way, I've heard it described as a Trojan horse approach, and there's one in particular, belantamab mafodotin, that we'll talk about. Now, can you explain a little bit about what an antibody-drug conjugate is and a little bit about what belantamab is? Actually, two of the patients, including the next one that you're going to see, are your patients who've been on this particular drug, which now is actually not even FDA approved. Right. We could talk a lot about what's going on from that point of view, but this next patient has been on it 3 years. You had another patient on it 4 years. How do these drugs work? How does belantamab work?
Well, it is the Trojan horse, as you said. So the antibody part of this molecule binds again through BCMA, but then the molecule is internalized and releases an actual drug into the cytoplasm that eventually helps the cell, helps destroy the cell. And so you're the targeting is there for that protein, but that's not the mechanism of action. It's to get the drug inside. And both Sagar and I had the privilege and the opportunity to work on one of the very early studies with this. And I think, you know, belantamab is a quite interesting and quite promising drug. I think at the time that Sagar and I were working, we saw about a third of patients had these amazing responses. About two-thirds did not. And I think we still don't understand exactly why some individuals had those fantastic responses. What about their myeloma caused that? And I think we've both been delighted seeing some of the combinations now with this drug that have come out that look very promising.
So, Sagar, I was mentioning that last week we actually did a webinar for oncologists on eye issues in oncology. Mm-hmm. And where you see ocular issues in general is with antibody drug conjugates like belantamab. Again, there are multiple antibody drug conjugates, lung cancer, bladder cancer, mm-hmm. breast cancer, where they're using these agents. The program we did last week was just about eye issues. We had an ophthalmologist on. And the patient that you're about to see, who, again, has been on belantamab, had this sort of keratitis, or I guess it's kind of actually damage to the cornea that is reversible. Before we hear the patient, though, Sagar, any comments about these ocular issues? How do you pick them up? How do you avoid them?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you don't understand something, there's a lot of concern and anxiety around it, and that extends to the medical community. The reality is that the toxicity associated with belamaf is reversible, as you just described, and there is no permanent damage done to the cornea. It's about forming these little cysts that come on the periphery and then work their way medial, and they can impact visual acuity, but they are also very quick to resolve. And what most of us do when we see them is change the dose and the frequency in between the dosing to allow for this to be much less significant than it was with the first or second dose. So it is very, very addressable or manageable.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, this issue of dose reduction and separation that, you know, again, you're seeing throughout oncology was very vividly demonstrated here. This agent is in front of the FDA right now. We're waiting to see if it comes back on the market. It was taken off not because of a problem, but because there was a trial that showed it wasn't better than another agent. But these more recent trials, it seemed in combination more effective than one of the most effective types of drugs we have in myeloma, the anti-CD38 antibodies. This one was daratumumab, and it was actually much more effective. But again, these people often have eye issues that have to be managed, and I think this patient's a good example.
When I first started getting treatment, I got the full dose that they give to start, and I'm pretty susceptible to the corneal little cysts that you get. And so I got it really bad right after the first one. I had to buy myself a magnifying glass about that big so that I could look at anything or read anything. And it took, I think, probably the full 9 weeks to get so that I was better. But after that, I get cysts, but they're in the corners of my eyes. And they distort the cornea a little bit so that if I'm looking at point sources, I can see that there are a bunch of little point sources overlapping. But, you know, your head takes care of that. And other than that, I've got better than 20/20 vision. And so it really hasn't bothered me.
When you think about it, how much of a problem has the eye issue been for you?
Aside from the fact that I have to remember to put drops in, it's not been an annoyance at all.
So, Natalie, anything you want to say about that? And also the future, not only of belantamab, but other ADCs in myeloma?
I think they are going to be more coming. In terms of this patient's experience, again, this is a person that has been on a trial at our place. One of the issues that I think has led to some of the side effects and experiences is that we were locked into a dosing schedule that I think most of us would not use outside of a trial, which was an every 3 week dosing schedule. But having said that, in this particular iteration of the study, I don't know if this person mentioned it to you, but this has brought one of the best responses in any of the treatments that he's had in any of the trials, which has been and absolutely lasted the longest, which has been very, very good.
No, I mean, I'm sure, Sagar, you've seen patients like this who've gone several years. This man's quality of life is great. Any thoughts again about where things might be heading in the future? Do you see this agent or other ADCs coming into myeloma therapy?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, one of the struggles we had at the ODAC meeting a week or so ago was trying to help everybody understand how to make these adjustments. And there were several patients actually who testified that, you know, for a couple of days they have changes in vision, but other than that, they're able to do what they want to do. The other 28 days out of the month or 6 weeks, depending upon what the dosing frequency is. You know, one of the things that has struck me is we're actually using Bella as maintenance post-transplant for high-risk patients. And we combine it with Pomdex, like you saw in the DREAM-A trial. And we dose it every 8 weeks for the first two doses, and then every 12 weeks after that. And it is the easiest high-risk maintenance we've given since we started doing triplet maintenance about 15 or 20 years ago. So it really is very straightforward. And once you get the dose and frequency right, it has minimal impact on a patient's quality of life or even their ability to do their activities of daily living. And there are other ADCs that are coming in myeloma.
And again, here's our faculty's response. And again, this happens all the time in oncology. You see a drug that works really well, it becomes available, it's FDA approved. And then even after that, people learn how to use it, how to adjust the dosing based on, it happens breast cancer, every type of cancer. Again, when we ask the faculty about efficacy, everyone is kind of expresses the fact that this is a very efficacious therapy. The same comments about ophthalmic issues that you've just heard, manageable and generally preventable by managing this. Often optometrists or ophthalmologists are following the patient. Actually, there's some centers that actually evaluate the patient right in the center with a portable evaluation. It doesn't have to be a really complicated issue. We're going to see where this and other therapies head. I want to finish out with some general issues about that I heard from these patients that I thought would be interesting to hear you comment on. Mm-hmm. First, the issue of interacting with the oncology team, not just the medical oncologists, but the nurses, nurse practitioners, et cetera, but particularly as it relates to chatting with them as well as with the family. Here are some comments.
I think that when you're first diagnosed, you're just kind of in this vacuum of shock. And it's so hard sometimes to focus further out than just that moment of fear. And I remember about 2 or 3 weeks out, I needed to find my voice so that when I came in for treatment, whether I was getting an infusion or talking to the doctor, that no question was too small, no question was too silly.
I come into every appointment with a list of questions. When I had my 100-day checkup after the stem cell transplant, I had over 100 questions. And one of the other doctors, she's like, you cannot ask Dr. O'Neill 164 questions. You need to come up with 6. So I went in and I told him what happened. He's like, go ahead, let's do this. And I said, are you sure? And he's like, absolutely.
I am a straight shooter. I like the information as it's happening. The more information you give me, the more comfortable I will feel. And I need to know everything. If I'm going to die, you could tell me that. And that I really am invested in being an advocate for myself and others. But I really want to know exactly what's going on. There's a lot of patients that don't feel that way.
A lot of people actually don't want to hear treatments. Just take care of it and tell me when to be here. I do. I need to know.
So, Natalie, every July I'm thinking, oh, all these new interns and residents are coming into the hospitals. I'm curious what you say to your first year oncology fellows as they come into your clinic for the first time about how you interact with patients and their families.
Well, I think the first person who spoke, I think that is a very important thing for a fellow or a new oncologist to remember is you can do a spectacular job the first meeting you have with a person and their family and, you know, give lots of information. But it never fails to impress me if you then see that person again, you know, in a short period of time. Mostly you could almost be saying, you know, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I think people are just sort of reeling from this whole experience. And it really does take time and repetition to try to get people familiar. One of the things that I think is always a little bit different for myeloma than treating other types of cancers, we have our weird staging system. It's not 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, sort of by definition, it's metastatic already. I mean, people have some inkling about oncology and I think it's a lot to expect patients to learn some of the terminology. That takes time. And then I think the other thing that's very, very, so I really tell our fellows, you need to get a vocabulary that you yourself are comfortable speaking with patients so that you can really try to help them understand what are some of the basics that we're looking at. But the other part that I really agree with is, and I'm sure Sagar would also say this is helpful, we need a team. We have a team, and there are multiple people. One of the things that's always in some ways so helpful, if somebody from that team comes back and says, you know, this patient asked me the question about this, and it seems really clear to me that they're not understanding. And I think as a physician, you are very familiar with that idea that patients sometimes don't want to ask you something. They either think it's not appropriate or maybe, you know, more like or they're going to show you that they don't understand something and they're nervous about saying that. So I do think having a lot of teammates, nurses, pharmacists, advanced practitioners helping us care for the entire patient and the family, for that matter, is really important.
Sagar, any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And to me, the team concept is just critical. When I see a new patient at the end of that visit, my PharmD will often go in after me. The nurse goes in after me. I bring an APP in with me because, you know, the reality is that people think we do it all and we don't. We have a great team around us that makes us look really good, and feeling comfortable with that team, knowing who's answering the messages most of the time, is really important for reducing a patient's individual anxiety at any given moment. You know, I had a really funny moment with a new patient about a month ago where they wanted to make sure that I knew everything that was going on in the field at the time to make sure that their loved one got the best care they could. And so they brought in a stack of 10 different manuscripts. And after about the fifth, the rest were all my papers. And so it was sort of fun to say, yep, I know that. See that name there? And then, so, I think people just want to make sure that you're giving them the latest and greatest recommendations.
So one final snippet of video, a couple other issues that came up in my discussion with these patients. I'll just ask for your brief comments, beginning with some thoughts about vaccines.
What is the best protocol for managing through vaccines? I've had umpteen COVID vaccines.
You were asking about how experts use corticosteroid medications. What's your experience been?
The problem with the Dex is that you're energetic and high for about 3 days, and then you mm-hmm. fall off a cliff, and you just absolutely, for 2 days, you're feeling like the Tin Man in Wizard of Oz. And then everything starts to come back again.
I want to know about the veins and keeping the veins healthy. I want to know about marijuana and THC. Is that helpful? I have a infrared sauna sitting right here next to me. I have red light. I drink greens powder, and I have compounded supplements that are made mm-hmm. just for me. Lots of questions about traveling. Very worried about my bones. So, you know, about caffeine, and then worried about alcohol, you know, and Dr. O'Neill's like, yeah, have a glass of wine, have a cookie, right? He's much more sure. And I'm like, I don't know.
So, Natalie, any thoughts about vaccines, infections, corticosteroids?
I do. You know, I have to say I am a big proponent of vaccines. I think that they have done a more for health in the world than pretty much anything else you could think of. But I think we do ask patients to take a lot of vaccines, particularly if they've had a stem cell transplant, then a CAR T. I think we're trying to get a little bit more strategic about, you know, can we check for some immunity? But I think they are important. And I do think that we should explain to people why this is. I would love to have an entire meeting about supplements. I have strong feelings about these, and I think I'm fascinated by it. I guess this is your patient, Sagar, because I think this is an area where people are very reluctant to share what they are actually doing, and I think people do a lot of things, and so I think the more we can get people to feel comfortable, as this individual did, to talk about all the different things they're doing, I think that's actually a good thing that comes up.
So, Sagar, you know, we talk about the bispecifics, all these incredible technology things, but one of the oldest treatment is corticosteroids, and they can actually cause significant problems. What do you see, and how do you prevent and ameliorate issues from steroids? And any comments about, you know, complementary strategies?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of steroid dosing, the one story that I'll often bring up is that if you look back in one of the early ECOG studies comparing Thal-Dex with Dex, I think it was, or maybe it was Lendex with Dex, I think what we learned is that the efficacy of steroids alone is about 4 months. It's really not that long. So, you know, when you're using steroids as part of a quad, you've got three other drugs to do some of the heavy lifting there. So I'll start off with a big dose of steroids to help debulk and maybe treat some side effects. But then we very rapidly get patients off. And for patients that are taking Darolendex, for instance, that are on for a long period of time, the Dex is usually gone between month 6 and 12. Right. Even with Dara, we stop giving Dex after the first 3 or 4 cycles of therapy. So I think it is something we probably do overdo a little bit, but it can be managed. In terms of supplements, you know, the one point that I often make is we studied green tea and vitamin C and its interaction with bortezomib and have published that it totally blocks the effects of bortezomib. Right. Right. We have not studied most of the other supplements. And so what I tell people is we don't know what those are doing. Right. And they may be counteracting what it is that you want to get out of the medication. We have studied. So you take it at your own risk. I don't recommend it, but you can't tell people what to do.
So, Natalie and Sagar, thank you so much. As always, I love talking to both of you, and this has been a great experiment.
Yeah.
Particular thanks to the 9 people who were nice enough to spend some time with me that you saw here today. And for those of you attending, thank you very much as well. Be curious about your feedback. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Natalie. Thanks, Sagar.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Yep.